ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Apparently, ultra-processed food, which is something we'll define in a minute, accounts for 42% of Australian adults' total energy intake. Do we even know what they are? A landmark three-paper series in the leading medical publication, The Lancet, has linked ultra-processed food to a lot of chronic disease. In fact, chronic diseases across nearly every major organ system. And the report calls for urgent, coordinated global action comparable to the campaigns against the tobacco industry. That's what they're saying. It's just as dangerous as tobacco. Tonight, we're joined by two of the leading Australian researchers who contributed to this publication, this three-paper series, to discuss what they are. Dr. Philip Baker is one of Australia's foremost experts on global food systems and health, as an ARC Future Fellow at the University of Sydney. He's researched how ultra-processed food corporations have globalised their operations and influenced policymaking everywhere. He's documented how big companies like Coca-Cola, Nestle and McDonald's have expanded everywhere to invade kitchen cupboards everywhere. Phil, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Philip. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's pleasure to be here.
No, terrific to have you. It's a most interesting topic. My second guest is Associate Professor Georgi Skrinas. Georgi is internationally recognised for his analysis of nutrition science and the role of big companies, alternative proteins and dietary advice. So, Georgi, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Yeah.
Yeah, good to have you with us too. All right. To get everyone on the same page, Georgi, can we start with you? What is this? What is ultra-processed food anyway? What are you talking about?
Yeah, so it's a particular type of with many different types of processed foods. We've been processing foods for many, centuries, obviously, but it's a particular type of processed food which has really been around for over a century, really, but it's really crept up and really taking over the food supply. So here we're talking about industrially processed foods, but the way they're produced is what's important. They're very technologically intensive. It's not really starting with whole ingredients, but a basic set of ingredients like grains and sugar, soy, sugars, and also meat and dairy. These ingredients are broken down to their component parts, and then they put it back together to make the whole range of food that we see on our supermarket shelves.
Yeah.
And often with the help of a whole range of additives as well to give them their flavour and colour and to make them appear very similar to minimally processed foods that we're familiar with, but they really can be contrasted with them.
I've seen a figure that says 42% of people's diets, roughly, is these things. Can that be right?
It is, and that's because largely a lot of the processed foods now on the supermarket shelves and in fast food chains are now ultra-processed, and they're steadily displacing minimally processed and even just processed foods from our diets and from the whole food supply. And that's the extent to which these food companies really are starting to absolutely define our diets. And Australia has one of the highest consumption rates in the world, 42%.
That seems a lot. I get if you're starting your day with a massive bowl of Fruit Loops and white sugar, you're probably not doing yourself a favour. But then if you are tucking into that, you know you're not doing yourself a favour as well. But you're saying that it's beyond that. There are all sorts of other foods.
And it's not just the obvious things like the confectionery, say, and the snack foods, but it's even the everyday foods. I mean, most of our bread now is ultra-processed.
Really?
Which means there's a whole lot of it's really been stripped back. There's very little whole grains or flour even.
Rewind here. What do you mean most bread is ultra-processed? I mean, if I buy a loaf of wholemeal bread, isn't that okay?
It might be okay, but it is a lot of it's in the supermarkets is ultra processed because there's a whole lot of additives that have gone in there to make that bread what it is. Like there's lots of water, makes very spongy. It's quite a technological feat to produce this bread. So it's partly the additives which is a marker of these processed foods, but also what you might spread on that bread, like the margarine.
I'm spreading butter on it.
Okay. Butter is minimally processed. We'd call that a mini processed. But the margarine, though, is a highly technological product. Mm. It's been around for a century, but it's turning vegetable oil, solidifying vegetable oil, a whole lot of additives in there. And if you go to dinner time, if you think about reconstituted meats like chicken nuggets, which are really just chicken stuck back together.
I don't want to get to dinner yet because we haven't got past breakfast yet. Most of the bread we eat, you'd say, is ultra processed.
It is, yeah.
Uh, Okay. All right.
And that doesn't mean, be clear, it doesn't mean it's necessarily unhealthy. And that's the wrong way to think about these foods. The old way we used to talk about some of the poorer quality processed foods was that they were junk foods. Mm. But this is about the technological processes and the additives used in the production. And there is perhaps often a degradation of the nutritional quality of the food. It doesn't necessarily make them what we might call unhealthy or non-nutritious.
Okay.
But it's where to be – I mean – you know, okay. there are nutritional concerns, but it's also when these foods become the dominant part of our diets and displace the minimally processed nutritious foods, that's when it really becomes a concern. That's what our evidence is telling us. It's the highest consumers of these products have the highest health
impacts. I'm trying to get to the 42% though, because, okay, so we're having bread, we're having toast for breakfast, and we're having Vegemite on that. Well, that's probably ultra processed, I guess. I've got a couple of eggs here. They're okay, aren't they? They're in eggs in the shell.
Yep.
Can't process them.
Look, I'm drinking
tea. Okay, I'm having a cup of tea or a cup of coffee with milk. Milk's okay, isn't it?
Yep. Most milk would be okay.
Not ultra processed. Okay, we've survived at breakfast time, unless we had the bowl of Fruit Loops with sugar. What about Weet-Bix? Is that okay?
Look, to be honest, I don't know precisely how Weet-Bix is produced. It might be quite minimally processed in itself.
Yeah.
It's often there are versions, of course, of breakfast cereals which are quite simple.
Hmm.
But most of the stuff on the shelves is, the grain's been highly sort of broken down, gone through an extruder, and really there are many additives which are giving that breakfast cereal structure, flavour. You know, even appearance, the additives are really key. And does that 42% figure, it's really important to note that that's an average in Australia. That's the average.
That seems like a lot to me, though. Yeah.
But in fact, some the highest consumers of ultra-processed foods in Australia, up to 70% of their diet is ultra-processed, whereas the lowest consumers, 20% and less. So it's a huge variation. It's a sign of the extent to which the food industry now is really doing our cooking for us.
I'm talking with our guests tonight. Georgi Skrinis is an associate professor of food politics and policy at School of at the University of Melbourne, and Dr. Phil Baker too, University of Sydney. Jump in here too on this as well. I mean, it's the function of big corporations. We talk about big oil, big pharma. Now you say we should be talking about big food as well, do you?
Yeah, well, we talked about big fossil fuel, big pharma, big tobacco, and now we're talking about big food. And just to give you an idea about the corporations or companies that we mean here, it's the PepsiCo, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Mondelez, Unilever, Danone. These are big transnational corporations. They are truly global. They own thousands of trademark brands, and they generate trillions of dollars in revenue globally every year. It's them. Those are the manufacturers. Those are the ones that you'd be familiar with on your supermarket shelves. But behind those companies are also other corporations that provide the ingredients that Georgi was talking about. So those that are producing the soy, the wheat, the sugar, the palm oil that goes into these foods, there's a whole other industry that sits behind it.
Okay.
That's what I mean by big food.
I'm continuing our progress through the day here, Georgi, because I'm just puzzled at the 42%. But anyway, so we've made it out of breakfast, I think. We know that if we're eating the sweet, sugary cereals, then, you know, we're not doing ourselves a favour. That's an example of what you're talking about. You say bread can be a culprit here. Presumably you can buy bread you'd think would be okay.
Yeah, of course.
But eggs on toast, that's okay. What else do people love for bread? Well, coffee and tea, you say the milk's okay. Moving on to lunch, I've got a ham, cheese, tomato sandwich, toasted. Any good?
The bread might be ultra processed. It depends if the hams, is it real ham? Is it reconstituted hams? I mean, each one of the ingredients in those products or the whole thing could be thought of as ultra processed. And often it's down to who's producing it, in what form you're is it? And really often it comes down to whether it's been freshly prepared that day or not. And that's really what's happened to our food supply, where eating less and less freshly prepared meals. And whether it's ourselves preparing it in the home or it's in a cafe, a restaurant, or a school canteen, it's that shift away from freshly prepared foods to these pre-prepared foods, often packaged, but they could be in a fast food joint as well. And it's largely big companies that are producing those foods now, and most of those foods that are being pre-prepared are ultra-processed by definition.
So, well, one of my texters says, I worked for Sanitarium for many years. I mean, they're the company that make Weet-Bix. I mean, I don't want to get too fixated on one product, but Weet-Bix is produced, my texter says, by cooking natural grain. Then you add riboflavin and iron in the cook. You dry it out, you squish it between rollers, and then you roll it up it gets squashed again into biscuit shapes, passes through another dryer, I guess, then packaged. So I think it's one of the things that isn't particularly processed. I mean, it's not true to say, is it, that any food that's in a box is ultra processed?
No.
Or you'd say there's a good chance it is.
Because it is. And look, this is a technical definition. It's really clear what the definition is. And once again, we're not saying that all these foods necessarily are directly harmful. So it's the wrong way to think about this. Mm. But it is a shift away from simply prepared and freshly prepared foods. And even those grains going through an extruder, which is a really high pressure, intense, technologically intense process, it's not the same as eating a whole grain or a bread, made from whole grains. So there are differences, and there is a level of degradation of nutritional quality of foods that goes on as each of these foods and their ingredients go through these processes. And it's about adding all that up together. And once again, if it's half your diet of these foods, that's a lot of where that health impact's coming from, and from the displacement of minimally processed foods.
I'm still trying to get to the half. Okay, we've moved on to now in the afternoon. We had a snack of a chocolate bar. Well, if you look at the ingredients there, that's not very good. So there's plenty of sugar in that. So okay, let's say that's a mark against us. Moving to dinner, we've had a glass of beer, a bottle of beer. Is that an ultra processed food?
Probably not.
Okay. Yep. Then we had, what did we have for dinner? We had a bowl of spag bol. How are we going with this? Minced meat, tinned tomatoes, cheese.
Once again, you can buy mince. You can make minced meat from real meat, or you can buy ultra processed versions of that. Right. Most pasta is probably minimally processed, but it can vary. And the cheese you use could be minimally processed or ultra processed. So, I mean, there's ultra processed alternatives to minimally processed foods throughout the whole food supply, and often they're the cheaper ones now. And that's what's accounting for the rise in consumption, partly because we're increasingly demanding convenience foods for all sorts of reasons, and necessarily these need to be relatively cheap to afford them, and people. Yeah. With under financial pressure and time pressure as well, are reaching for these foods, and that's really what's driving the production and the consumption of these foods.
Dessert, we had some fruit and ice cream.
Yeah, and so once again,
ice cream is probably a no-no, is it?
Not necessarily. I mean, you can actually buy commercial ice creams with with five ingredients and so on, and you can put real fruit in that, or you can buy a fruit flavored ice cream, which has a whole lot of additives, including artificially flavored fruit rather than the real fruit.
Mm. Yeah, Philip. I mean, there was a wonderful book I read some years ago. In fact, I did an interview with the author. It was called Sugar, Fat, Salt, I think, or maybe it was the other way around. But the author who wrote that, you guys, I think, are probably familiar with it, but the author's thesis here was, in large part, it was a history of an American company called United Foods, they were the ones that invented things like the instant pudding, for example, and I don't know whether they invented dead potato, but they might have. And they invented, reconstituted fruit juices and so on. But they became incredibly successful, and there were other companies too. But partly because they tried to cram, and they found a way to cram as much sugar and salt into foods as they could, because these are the things that press buttons for people. Is that pretty much the story, Philip?
Yeah, that was such a good book, wasn't it? Sure, I think it was Sugar, Salt and Fat by Michael Moss.
Moss, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, and what he talks about is how the companies design the products to create this bliss point. So you have this you know, this perfect combination of sugar, salt, and fat that triggers something in the human, you know, the human brain. It triggers this hedonic response that makes us or compels us to eat more of that product. And of course, that's what the companies want, because if you eat more of the product, you buy more of the product, they make more profit. But we have, the science has now gone way beyond just sugar, salt, and fat. And I think this is why your listeners might find reading the Lancet papers that we did really interesting, because what the science says in the first paper of the series is that it is the sugar, salt, and fat, but it is also the soft texture of the food. So these are foods that do not contain, or typically do not contain, any whole ingredients. They contain these extracts from, you know, the soy, the palm, the wheat, these degraded ingredients that mean that these foods are really soft. They're almost pre-digested or pre-chewed, which means it doesn't take as much chewing time or effort to consume them. So we consume more of it. They also are more energy dense. We think that higher energy density per unit of the food may also be making us consume more of them. And then just to add to that, there is also the marketing. The companies spend billions of dollars every year convincing us that these are highly desirable products,
yeah,
right?
They're trying to sell things. That's right. Julia in Canberra says, Phil, I'm looking right now at a box of Weet-Bix Organic. I don't want to get hooked up on Weet-Bix, but it's an Australian product, a box of Weet-Bix Organic. The ingredients are listed on the box as organic whole grain wheat, organic sugar, salt, barley malt extract. I've seen a far worse list of ingredients, says Julia. Well, she's right, isn't she, Georgi? That this is not particularly grim, even though you say it's an ultra processed food.
Actually, I didn't say. I said it may not be. So, yeah. And also, just to be clear, I mean, this is a huge. If it's 42% of the food supply, then it's a huge variety of foods we're talking about. Right. And of course, they're going to vary greatly in nutritional quality from one product to the next. Now, but the point about this is the kind of processing it's gone through, the kind of ingredients used, and the additives means when you compare a particular food with a minimally processed counterpart, that there's going to be some sort of nutritional, you know, decline in quality. So, for example, you can compare that breakfast cereal with, you know, whole oats, for example, which you could also, you know, prepare in your kitchen very quickly, and there is a difference there. So it is about making those sort of comparisons, not comparing, you know, apples and pears so much.
Yeah, I guess so. Although porridge, I'm sure, gets the treatment in some ways as well.
No.
Philip, I've got a box of Nutrigain in front of me.
Oh, yeah.
I can read the ingredients out for you if you like.
Yeah, no, I want you to. Here we go. Yeah, go on.
So it contains wheat flour, maize flour, which is corn flour, sugar, wheat protein. So wheat protein is protein that has been extracted from wheat.
Right.
Maltodextrin, molasses, oat fiber, vegetable gum, salt, minerals, raising agent, flavors, colors, and vitamins. So this is very, very clearly an ultra-processed food.
What's maltodextrin? What's that?
I think that is a modified starch that is extracted from maize, I think, corn. I could be wrong.
No, sure. But I suppose my argument, I'm not arguing anything. I'm just observing. But that if you bought a box of, say, Nutrigrain, you probably know that it's had the treatment, don't you? Whereas I guess if you're buying a box of Weet-Bix, you think maybe it hasn't had the treatment. And anyway, largely that seems to be the case.
Yeah, but when you look at the packaging, and I'm looking at the packaging right now, on the front of the box it says real nourishment, protein, iron, fiber, multi-grain, and B vitamins. On the back it says fuel for active bodies, and it has a picture of a young man playing cricket, and it's got a 4-star health star rating on it. So, you know, it's covered in claims, it's covered in this marketing saying that it's a healthy food, right?
The star system's a government system, isn't it?
It is, yep.
How does it get a 4-star rating?
Well, this is part of the history of the Health Star rating, and it's actually under scrutiny at the moment because in one of the papers, we say how the Health Star rating system has essentially been sort of co-opted by the industry as a marketing tool.
Mm.
And it's an example of what you get when governments decide to design policies with the food industry. And that's exactly what the Australian government did in this case. They designed the Health Star rating system with the food industry. We got the Health Star rating system. And 10 years later, it only appears on 37% of products. And those are products that tend to score favorably, even though many of them are ultra processed.
Mm.
So that is sort of, indicates it's being used as a marketing tool.
Mm. Yeah. I, again, just trying to get some definitional things here too. When we say processed food, I mean, to some degree, all food is processed and we process it. Not fresh vegetables, I guess. You take them home, chop them up and cook them. But the application of is the application of heat processing, Georgi?
No, we've been. In fact, that's what defines humans to some extent.
Exactly. We learned to cook food, didn't we?
Yeah, so it's not cooking per se. It's a much higher level of technological intervention in our food.
Right.
And what's important is the reason. What's interesting about the definition of ultra processed foods, it refers to not just how it's processed, but also why it's processed. What's driving that processing? What's the purpose of it?
Mm, mm.
And in the case of some of these products, it's not. To make nourishing, tasty foods for the people you care about, or even for a profit in a restaurant where but it's actually being driven by the attempt to create very cheap foods, also very profitable foods that are durable. You know, can be packaged, sit on the shelf for a long time, and not degrade over that time. And also made to be very tasty, and as Phil mentioned before, they're designed, they're engineered to be sort of over-consumed. That's what's driving the underlying the production of these foods. So it's not really driven by other more perhaps noble aims. And that really explains why the quality of these foods and so, of course, it's perfectly possible to produce prepared foods, processed foods that are of better nutritional quality, but that's not as profitable and it won't sell as much as and might also be more expensive than these ultra processed foods.
To some degree, I wonder, Philip, whether it's also a product though of modern life and modern society. It's all very well to say you should go and cook fresh food, fresh vegetables and fresh meat and so on. But for a lot of people, that's not necessarily easy or cheap. Fresh food can be very expensive, much more expensive than the stuff in a can or a box. And depending on what your setup is at home, it might be much easier to eat that way. If you're outside of main distribution centres, you can forget fresh food in many instances, unless you can grow it yourself. This is also a fact of life, isn't it? That people often don't have a choice.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're exactly right. At least in Australia, at least in the United States and the United Kingdom, where such a huge part of the population in our country is dependent on ultra-processed foods, these really cheap food commodities. But this is absolutely not the case in many other countries around the world. Yeah. So China, South Korea, Japan, even, like Italy and Greece, they have much lower levels of ultra-processed foods, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what explains that? There's something going on with the way we organize our society that, makes us eat more or less of these foods. Part of it is to do with culture and, these traditional dietary patterns are still very, strong and going well in those countries.
Mm.
But a lot of it comes down to just how powerful these corporations are within the food system, within the food environment. In Australia, we've had these corporations here for a very long time. The same in the United States. We are surrounded by the commercial marketing. If you go into the supermarket, it's the large majority of foods on the shelf are ultra processed. So, you know, we are an ultra processed nation, if you can put it that way.
I suppose I'm just trying to get to that. So you say if I walk into a supermarket, most of the things I see on the shelf will be ultra processed.
Yeah. So if you leave aside the fresh, you know, the fruit and vegetable section, if you go into those center aisles,
what about canned baked beans?
Yep. Yeah, it'll be. Well, it depends. Some brands won't be, but a lot of brands are ultra processed. Yeah, they have additives, and unfortunately, that's the case.
Hmm. Although what you're saying is, we've got to be careful here. It's not because we're not saying that processed food's necessarily bad, are we?
That's right. And we're not putting all processed foods in the same category.
Yeah.
But we are identifying this very distinct category of foods called ultra-processed. We have a very precise definition of it. Mm. That's what allows us to actually track the precise percentage.
Just give that again for us, for people who might have missed that.
What's that, the definition?
Yeah.
There's a wordy definition, but it really is foods that have been broken down to their component parts and put together again with a whole range of additives.
Mm.
That's a sort of colloquial way of putting it. We often identify them in practice by simply the presence of an additive. Like just one additive is a sign, is a proxy for a food that's actually gone through several stages of processing. Because if it's there, there's usually a reason why there's an added flavor or texturizer. It's because the foods have been so far removed from their sort of whole form that they need these additives to bring back the texture, the flavor, the color, and so on. And if they weren't there, you wouldn't want to eat them. They may taste horribly. They may look horrible. Their texture would be horrible. That's that's the role of many of these cosmetic additives in foods.
Mm. You might like to join us in this conversation or have a question yourself. 1-300-800-222 is my number. 1-300-800-222. You can text a question on 0467 922 702, but give us a call. Lines are free. You'll get through. 1-300-800-222. My guests are Dr. Phil Baker, who's with the University of Sydney, and Gheorghe Scrinas, who's with the University of Melbourne. They are both experts in their fields and associated with these Lancet papers about ultra-processed food, which suggest that some 42% of what is on offer for us in food and what we consume is ultra-processed. And this has all sorts of implications for health. So if you'd like to ask a question, 1-300-800-222.
Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Phil, to some degree, one of the problems in this that bedevils this whole area, reminds me of tobacco actually in some ways, is is getting some way for all of us, the average person in the supermarket, to be able to look at something and say, if it's in a box or a can or a container of any kind, it obviously has had some factory processing. Is it good for us or not? Now, you mentioned the star rating. And if that breakfast cereal you were talking about before has got a 4-star rating, you might ask yourself, well, obviously the rating system's not working. I presume companies have always resisted rating systems, have they?
They sure have, yeah. The companies actually proposed their own labelling system called the Recommended Daily Intake System.
Right.
You can still see them on some products today. They're sort of these really hopeless thumbnails that say, how much nutrients or your daily percentage of nutrients you should be consuming. They're completely useless as a way of judging the nutritional qualities of the food, and that's the point, right, from the companies. They don't want you to, kind of know how poor in quality these foods are. With the if we look at what's been adopted all around the world, if you go to Latin America, the governments over there have adopted these front-of-pack warning labels. There are these big black octagons. If they're high in fat, sugar, salt, some countries also have artificial sweeteners on there as well. Then they get these big black warning labels. And it's sort of like a stop sign saying, think again about this choice. Whereas the health star rating system, I think there was a lot of good intention behind it, but it was just so poorly designed from the very beginning because of this partnership with the industry. And, you know, if you just walk around the supermarket, it is helpful in identifying some unhealthy foods, but there are just so many examples everywhere you look where these really unhealthy ultra-processed foods are carrying 4 stars, 5 stars. And, you know, is that helping Australians to make a healthy choice? It's absolutely not.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Brad, Brad's on the line. G'day, Brad.
What's that?
Hi, Brad.
Yeah, how you going, mate?
Yeah. You worked in the Weet-Bix factory, did you?
Yeah, I worked at Uncle Toby's, mate. I used to cook the Weet-Bix, mate. My mum used to take them on the end of the line.
Hang on, Uncle Toby's don't make Weet-Bix, do they? That's sanitarium, isn't it?
One of the two.
Anyway, go on, yeah.
No, Vitabrix, you got it back to front. That's the sanitarium makes Vitabrix. Uncle Toby's makes the Weet-Bix, yeah.
Okay, but go on.
Yeah, but, mate, when I was cooking it, what goes in the recipe is like malt, thiamine, and vitamins and this special ingredient they put in. Like, right. Even that's a high-processed bloody thing. Like, as you're saying, there ain't many things you come across these days that hasn't been processed, even though people don't realise.
Yeah, did you eat it yourself, Brad? Maybe if you worked in the factory making it all day, you didn't.
I still eat it this day. There was nothing better than eating it straight off the line. It was beautiful. But,
I can imagine.
Once again, it's funny that it gets broken down, gets mussed up, mate. Gets all these additives put in it, comes out of the line, goes through the cookers, mate, and comes out in a little biscuit that you eat.
Yeah. Thanks, Brad. It's interesting because I mean, this is what Georgi is saying. Not all processed food necessarily bad for you, but we're talking about a quite specific definition of what ultra processing is, which is. When levels of additives are in food that make it unhealthy for you. Peter from the Gold Coast. G'day, Peter.
G'day, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
It's not so much a question. It's just an observation. On the road, I used to buy a lot of processed foods, you know, all your fast foods every day.
Yeah.
It was super cheap. These days, it's, you know, 16 to 20 bucks for a meal.
Yeah.
It's getting out of hand, and I'm finding myself... One, not wanting to buy it because of the price, but two, I just seem to be craving good food. And some days I'll just go and buy an avocado and eat the avocado, and I'll be satisfied, you know. And I
know what you mean sometimes, don't you? When you've eaten too many burgers and stuff, you really just need your body craves for something fresh. It's a good point. This is a good point, Philip, isn't it? Because it's not as though. It's not as though these things are expensive necessarily. I mean, they're often cheaper than food that's good for you. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it kind of depends. On average, ultra-processed foods are typically cheaper than non-ultra-processed foods, and that's because the companies can produce them so cheaply.
Mm.
But then they also charge quite a bit of money for some foods, right? Like the ones that have all the claims on them. High in protein, low sugar, low carb, the sort of the more health orientated ones, they can actually price them quite high. But on average, yeah, I think this is a challenge, that these are just really cheap to buy. And that's part of the reason why, people rely on them and depend on them.
Mm.
But they're also very convenient as well. I mean, you know, you told the listener mentioned being on the road, and you know, if you drive down an Australian highway, you're going past the Hungry Jacks, you're going past the McDonald's, you're going past the Subway. Every 20 kilometres or so, that's ultra convenient, right? You don't even have to get out of your car a lot of the time. You can just drive it and grab it, and this is by design, right? Because the companies know if they do that. You're more likely to, purchase them. It's cheap. Yeah. It's convenient.
Georgi, my texter, Peter from Port Macquarie, has texted me the label of his light milk brand, and he says it seems to have sugar in it. Is this sugar natural or an added chemical?
If it's just cane sugar, for example, that itself – is considered a refined but still essentially minimally processed ingredient.
Sugar, why would you put sugar in milk?
Well, it makes it very palatable. So sugar itself is not part of the definition of ultra-processed foods, but at least two-thirds of ultra-processed foods tend to be high in salt or sugar or fat. So it is, once again, it's because those ingredients are cheap, they make foods very tasty, they give texture and so on.
Hmm. Yep. Wayne from Morissette. Hello, Wayne.
Hi there, how are you going?
Very well. What's up?
So we do our shopping at a large chain.
Yeah.
And some friends gave us this app to look at, which is called YUKA, Yuka.
Oh, the Yuka app. Yeah, yeah, I've heard of this. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. So you scan the barcode and it tells you a rating out of 100. And some of these four-star healthy foods are in the 20s, are bad for you.
Okay.
Because of the additives and the preservatives. And it's just changed the way we shop. We just scan what we need. It keeps a track of it.
Yeah.
And you then find something that's over 50 or 60 or 70, and or it gives you an alternative that's better than what supposedly tastes good that might be...
Yeah, we're getting. Thanks for ringing, Wayne, because we're getting quite a few texts on about this too. So one of my texters said, I've got a great little app called Yuka. It's a Danish initiative, apparently. So yep. Anyway, it gives it a score out of 100.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're basically shooting for a score over 70 on what you're buying, basically.
Theoretically, that's the better end of the market, but anything over 50 is considered good.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. Good on you, Wayne. Thank you.
No worries.
Phil and Georgie, have you heard of this Yuka app, and what do you think?
Yeah, I have, and I actually use it myself quite often. It's a really good app, easy to download. Just scan the product and gives you all of that information, including on the additives, and that's something that, as the caller said, the HSR doesn't do. There's also other apps that are out there as well. Yuka is one of the best.
Hmm.
If I can add, I mean, the issue with those, I mean, they're great, those apps, and they can give you a range of information beyond just a sort of the nutrient profile.
Yeah.
But it really is putting the emphasis and the responsibility back on the consumer to make those choices, assuming they have choices they can make, you know, in terms of time and affordability. And the sort of policy solutions that we were advocating in these Lancet series of papers is much more structural issues that change the whole food environment, change what's actually being produced and distributed and put on the shelves. Because really that's the sort of changes that need to happen. We need to begin to start regulating these products more seriously. And that means really tackling, you know, the availability of these foods and the affordability of them, the way they've, you know, displaced other foods from the food supply. And at the same time, trying to support the alternatives and make the alternatives affordable to people and accessible. And that's the real challenge.
Mm.
And we do have, there is, you know, some countries are leading the way around the world, certainly not Australia. There is a small range of a set of policies that are being sort of rolled out in some countries. Chile is in South America, and a number of South American countries are really leading the way. The policies I'm talking about are certainly the front-of-pack labelling policies, like the warning labels that Phil mentioned. Sugar taxes, a number of countries, including the UK, have introduced sugar taxes. And the third one is the restrictions on marketing to children, which is, I think, really important. It really gets at some of the sort of marketing power of companies.
You go.
Well, I mean, and look, this is a good start, and Australia is way behind in that sense. But unfortunately, these policies on their own aren't going to have a huge impact because they're not really tackling the very production of the foods in the first place or their availability. In other words, they're still being produced, and the supermarkets and the fast food chains are flooded with these foods. And then we're kind of begging consumers not to purchase them and eat them by putting a tax on or a warning label. And that's only going to get us so far.
Mm. My texter says mortadella, salami, and bacon must be really bad for you. I remember once doing an interview about bacon, and the nutritionist said, "Bacon on your birthday, that's it." I don't know. I mean, mortadella is a processed food, but boy, oh boy, it's delicious. Steve from Sanssouci, g'day, Steve.
Oh, hello, Phil.
G'day.
I had a question. I work as a shift worker, and I like to buy a processed meal from, not a processed meal, but a ready meal that I throw in the microwave. Are they any good?
Yeah. Are they any good, Georgie or Phil?
Well, there's probably a few corners that have been cut there, I guess, in terms of the quality of the ingredients, the sort of issues we've been talking about. Once again, it's let's not get hung up on this. We're not talking about banning all foods or, you know, it's about the quantity being produced. They're no longer an occasional treat or, you know, occasional snack food. We're serious about that figure of 42%, and it's much higher in other countries. In the US and the UK, it's 55%. And yet we know it's possible to eat differently. In France, it's under 30%. You know, in Japan, similarly, and Spain. So, you know, this speaks to a range. And also, don't forget, even within Australia, what we're saying is there are people who are eating really high levels of these foods and people who are not. So it's like it is possible to eat differently, although it is about access, about affordability, income, time, and so on, and work pressures to be able to sort of put that food on the table.
Mm. Yeah, I know. I was expressing some scepticism about it because I was taking you through, I would have thought, a fairly average day for a lot of people, and it's hard to get to 42% of processed food in that lot, but that we gave of toast and eggs, some cereal, you know, your meat, your ham, cheese, tomato sandwich, and your spag bol. But you say that this is not necessarily the diet that average people would eat.
Well, I'm saying even those foods you just mentioned, there are ultra processed versions of every one of those foods.
I know, but it wouldn't be 42% of what you're eating.
Yep, that's what our figures are telling us. And if I'm telling you, some people are eating 70%. That's one fifth of the population. Their diet is up to 70% ultra processed. I mean, and this is also, you know, it's becoming a very class based issue. It's, in, you know, when ultra processed foods first enter into a country, and this is what's happening now in low and middle income countries. Often it's people with higher income, disposable incomes, who can purchase some of these foods because they tend to be more expensive initially. But then, at a certain stage of that development, the script flips, and you know, people with higher incomes are eating the minimally processed foods. They go to restaurants and they're preparing foods freshly at home and buying lots of fresh vegetables because they can afford it and they have time. And it's people who may be on lower incomes, time pressure, working long hours, busy families, and so on, that are, you know, really compelled to reach for some of these convenience foods.
Jake from Sawtell says, "Phil, I work at a milk processing factory and I run the pasteuriser. And we do not add any sugar to milk. It comes from the farm to our factory, pasteurised, then bottled, nothing added to it whatsoever." Yeah, I'm sure that's probably right for a lot of milk production. When you look at the dairy cabinet, when you look at the dairy cabinet and you see all of this, I mean, yogurts are massive these days in all sort of shapes, forms and sizes. Yeah. Where does yogurt fit in on this spectrum?
Yeah. And that's a great example, because once you can just buy plain yogurt, which is largely just, you know, milk. That's all it is. That's all you need to make yogurt, milk. Nothing else needs to go in there. Sometimes some dairy powder is put in as well to sort of thicken it up a bit. But really, there's many yogurt brands, which typically the flavored ones, where they've skimmed. They've got other, maybe they're skimping on some of the dairy. They're adding some other ingredients to texturize the product, give it a longer life, but particularly the flavourings are almost invariably ultra-processed.
Mm. David from Narrabeen. G'day, David.
Hi there. How are you?
Yeah, good.
Listen, you know, I've been listening to this conversation with much interest, and I find it extraordinary that where is the evidence that any of this stuff is causing harm? A little bit like the PFAS situation we've got. Nobody seems to be getting sick.
I don't think that's right, David. I don't think that's right. We're not going to spread that view.
I know it's a different subject, but you know, some of this stuff comes out, and we've got sort of pseudo scientists saying these are causing harm.
Yeah, okay. All right, David, look, I'm not trying to get rid of it, but you can't. Our guests are not pseudoscientists. Philip and Georgi, just summarise the deleterious effects of these things.
Sure. I mean, I'll start. I mean, we present the evidence in the first paper in the Lancet series. So, and there's a whole range of evidence that, for example, we know we already, and the government's already concerned about foods that are considered high sugar, salt, fat because of the evidence based on those nutrients. So there's a starting point there, because a lot of these ultra-processed foods are high in fat, sugar and salt. So we can refer to the nutrient profile. We can also refer to specific evidence around specific ingredients in these products. But these products are all very diverse. But what this what the evidence around ultra-processed foods, the sort of evidence we have is broad epidemiological evidence, which means we're comparing the diets within a country of people who consume high amounts of these foods versus people who consume lower amounts. And what we find, and just an association, is that high consumers are associated with higher risk of a whole range of chronic diseases and conditions. And this is being repeated in multiple countries and multiple studies all around the world. They are just associations, but they're telling us there's a certain pattern here. There's a dietary pattern which is not particularly nutritious, sure, not particularly healthful. And there's lots of particular, more specific evidence within that which might start to explain those associations.
Gilgi, what about soy products and soy milks? These are highly processed, because if you look at the bean, where do you get milk out of that?
Just crushing a soybean itself
doesn't get you milk. No,
it does. I mean, you can produce soy milk, you can produce tofu just from crushing. But the interesting thing about soy, so soy is used for that purpose, but soy is in this incredible industrial crop that's produced that. It's broken down into a whole range of fractions to produce oils or fractionated ingredients, which go into a whole range of ultra-processed foods. It's also used to feed animals, to produce meat, and then that meat also then might become ultra-processed as well. So it's a classic industrial ingredient.
Meg from Como says, Phil, I don't think your typical brekkie is a typical Aussie brekkie. I think it's croissants, Fruit Loops, flavoured yoghurt, not eggs, Wheat Bix and coffee or tea. Yeah, Meg, I'm coming around to your place. It does sound, Look, I'm sure people eat all sorts of different things. Look, there's a lot of stuff to digest here. Just that app that people liked was, what was it again? Y-U-K-A, is that it?
Yep, that's the one.
Yeah, Yuka. Y-U-K-A. Check it out. I mean, a lot of people are saying that it's useful. Thanks to you two. It's been very interesting, Dr. Philip Baker and Professor Gyorgy Skrinas. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Philip.
Thanks, Phil.
Good on
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
See you, mate.
Interesting conversation.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.